Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What will it take to bring the Ebola outbreak threatening lives in three West African countries under control? And how prepared are healthcare systems to cope if the virus were to appear here in the United States? The CDC last week issued warnings advising Americans to cancel all non-essential travel plans to Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. Meanwhile, U.S. physician Dr. Kent Brantley, who did his medical residency at Fort Worth's John Peter Smith Hospital and had been working in Liberia caring for Ebola patients when he caught the disease himself, has arrived in Atlanta to receive care at Emory University Hospital. So how will doctors there try to help him survive the infection, and what measures will they take to ensure nobody else gets sick? We have an expert panel here to answer questions about Ebola this hour. Dr. Robert Haley worked in hospital infection control at the CDC, and he's currently professor of internal medicine and director of the Division of Epidemiology and Internal Medicine at UT Southwestern Medical Center. Dr. Seema Yasmin is a physician and journalist who has worked as a disease detective at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. She's currently a staff writer at the Dallas Morning News and a professor at UT Dallas. And Dr. Christy Columbus is assistant medical director of infection control and disease prevention for Baylor Scott & White Health North Division. Thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.
Sure.
I want to start with this basic information. What does the Ebola virus do to the body that makes it so lethal?
Well, it's really one of the most deadly viruses from that perspective. If you're infected with this virus, it goes all over your body and basically attacks every cell in your body. It has the biggest effect on the lining of the blood vessels, so that it causes them to leak and causes bleeding. But it also affects the liver, produces liver failure in the kidneys and kidney failure, and the immune system. So it's a really bad actor if you get it.
So contrary to what I think a lot of people believe, it's not that you lose so much blood that you die. It's multiple system failure, organ failure.
That's correct. It actually damages the blood vessels, so you tend to leak. It damages the liver, so you don't make the clotting factors that allow it to clot. So from all perspectives, sort of break down the body. But in some people, they develop antibodies very quickly to it, and if you keep them alive long enough, they'll survive. But that's maybe not even the majority of people.
Mm-hmm. And we don't know why some people develop those antibodies and others don't.
No, we just know in almost every disease, there's a lot of individual variation that's genetic in nature that causes some people to die from a disease, whereas most other people, it would not be fatal.
Mm-hmm. Are there critical stages in the disease where patients are at sort of a make or break point?
Typically, the patients that are alive at day 10. Mm-hmm. And so if they can make it past day 10, typically that is the point at which there's good prognosis afterward.
So that would seem to bode well, and I know that you haven't dealt with either of the patients personally, but it would seem to bode well for the two Americans that are being returned to Atlanta for care?
Yeah, actually, we just learned that, I think from Dr. Yasmin's reporting, we learned that that both patients received a new medication or you want to talk about it?
Sure.
Please do. Yeah.
So Dr. Brantley and Mrs. Wrightwell, we learned, received a dose of serum, and it's an experimental treatment for Ebola that's so far only been shown to be effective in monkeys, and even then only when the monkeys received it 48 hours after infection. It's called ZMAP. It's made by MAP Biopharmaceuticals, and it contains antibodies. So those are some of the body's first-line defenses against foreign invaders. What antibodies can do is kind of latch onto bacteria or viruses, try to mop them up so that you can fight the infection. And the way that they're made in cases like this, for example, is that mice are injected with Ebola, and then the scientists will wait for the body to produce those antibodies. They'll take blood from the mice, and then they'll very carefully select the antibodies specifically that fight Ebola. And so that's what Dr. Brantley and Mrs. Wrightwell have both received.
There were also reports that Dr. Brantley received a unit of blood from a teenage patient who had survived this particular outbreak. Is that true?
So we also heard that from the aid agency that he worked with. And again, it would be the same idea there, that this young person survived the infection. There must be antibodies in their blood that are really effective against Ebola. So let's give that blood to Dr. Brantley. When I spoke to experts at the Scripps Research Institute in California who work on these antibodies, they said that giving the serum that has these specific antibodies is much more effective than just giving a unit of blood, a whole blood, from a survivor.
Many people, of course, are concerned because we've heard now that this disease has an incubation period that can be a couple of weeks typically. Is that
three
correct?
Weeks.
3 weeks.
Can be up to 3 weeks. Usually about 10 days, can be as short as 2 days and as long as 21 days.
So someone could be infected and fly somewhere else in the world and develop symptoms and not even recognize them to be Ebola and walk around like maybe they have the early stages of the flu or something else. How much should we be concerned about our ability to keep this virus contained to the three countries where, unfortunately, it's causing so much trouble?
Well, actually, that's already happened. A government official from Liberia, I believe, flew to Lagos, Nigeria, with a connection in Togo, and he became ill while in flight, collapsed when he arrived at the airport in Nigeria, and subsequently died. And now they've reported two other suspicious cases in Nigeria. So it definitely happens, and in this country, we've been thinking about that for over 20 years. And all of our airports now have systems to look for cases like that and to handle them if they happen. For example, DFW has a very well-developed system. They have their own emergency medical personnel on site at the airport, and pilots are required by law to report before they open the doors if they have any sick passengers. So if you had a person who had flown from West Africa right now, who came in with fever, and just fever would be enough, who was sick, then they would be met, the plane would be met by one of these emergency medical personnel who would assess the situation and then handle it the appropriate way.
How does the disease work in terms of when it becomes infectious and when people who are infectious are sort of at the height of their ability to spread the virus?
Typically, it's thought that if the patient is asymptomatic but incubating the illness, they are not considered to be contagious at that point. They are considered to be contagious once symptoms develop. And the contagious exposure would be through exposure to the patient's blood or body fluids.
Yeah, and that's actually very fortunate. There are some other diseases, for example, measles or smallpox, where you're infectious for several days, perhaps, before you become sick. And that makes it much more difficult to control the spread of this. But Ebola, as Dr. Columbus points out, Ebola does not spread until you're sick. So that's a major advantage in control.
It is an advantage, except that we all think about Ebola as this horrific, scary, scary disease. And actually, the early symptoms might be fever, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. What does that sound like? It sounds like so many diseases. Mm-hmm. And especially in these parts of the world, people think they have malaria. So they won't automatically think, I have a very contagious illness, I need to be quarantined. So that's one of the concerning factors here.
There seems to be an advantage, am I correct, in seeking treatment immediately once those symptoms begin, as opposed to waiting 4 or 5 days and thinking, hey, I'm not getting better here.
Absolutely. And I think that speaks to the fact that we don't have a specific treatment or a cure for this disease. And what you can do is try to keep the patient alive for as long as possible so that their immune system kicks in, starts making those antibodies, and starts fighting off the infection.
Why is this particular outbreak harder to control than some that we've seen in recent years?
You know, typically we saw Ebola outbreaks in very remote villages in Central Africa, typically close to rainforests, much smaller outbreaks. We've seen some that were in the 400s many, many years ago. We've had outbreaks more recently that were 10, 11 people died. This time what's concerning is it's gone so quickly to big cities. And we keep talking about air travel, but actually there's a lot of travel there by foot and by road. So where before you might go to investigate an outbreak in this small village, now you go to a village and find out that some of the people have already gone to another village. And then those folks have gone to another town, and then they've gone to a capital city. And so it's spread much quicker than we've ever seen.
Also, there's a major cultural contribution here, is that in those cultures, people tend to take care of their sick relatives at home. And so they bathe them, take care of them and are exposed to their blood and body fluids at home. And then when the people go to the hospital, their hospitals are much less developed than ours. They're very primitive. And so, in fact, some of the older outbreaks back in the 70s and 80s, there might be an outbreak going on of Ebola. Nobody would recognize it until several doctors or nurses died. Mm. And so in an African setting, when you see some doctors and nurses dying, that's when you know there's an Ebola outbreak going on. But it testifies to the primitive conditions of their hospitals and how they take care of their family members.
How do modern hospitals in developed countries isolate patients who have something that is this dangerous and this infectious?
Well, typically, we would isolate them the same way that we would for any blood or body fluid transmitted type of illness. And so it would be the healthcare worker would put the patient into a private room. They have their own bathroom. They have their own dedicated critical equipment. The healthcare worker would wear appropriate, what we call personal protective equipment, an impervious gown, eye protection, face mask, gloves, shoe, and leg covers if warranted by the situation as well. So this is something that we have a vast amount of experience with in terms of isolation.
And are there, I understand that the gear goes on and people are in rooms that are sort of sealed off, and then you have to get that gear off and make sure that everything is clean. Are there like antechambers outside of each patient's isolation room?
Not necessarily. I understand that in these types of situations, like for fairly for diseases that you are concerned that may be spread by blood body fluids or airborne route, or maybe aerosolization of blood body fluids, you would have an antechamber there. Most of the time when we are isolating patients with blood and body fluid-borne diseases, we remove the equipment either in an anteroom or sometimes right inside the patient's room immediately before departing.
Yeah, I think it's important to emphasize that in American healthcare setting, we're not really concerned that this is going to do to healthcare workers are spread around the community like it does in Africa. And that has to do with the much greater organization of our hospitals, a 40-year history of a very vigorous effort to control infections in hospitals. We have all of our hospitals have very organized infection control programs that would contain this. We've seen that the Dr. Brantley and Ms. Rutbull have been brought back. Dr. Brantley was brought in very, very carefully controlled tent on a special plane and had a hazmat suit, went into Emory Hospital. That's a CDC high containment facility.
Was able to walk on his own, though. Which
yes.
Is a
yeah.
Wonderful
but,
sign.
But that sort of made it look like that we would have to do that for anybody with Ebola. But with our modern infection control techniques, we're very confident that was an extra precaution that they took, I think possibly because it was such a public, in so much in the public eye. But in our hospitals, we would expect that not to spread around. We've take care of very dangerous diseases fairly often in our hospitals, and we don't see spread like that. So we would control it pretty well in this country.
We're speaking this hour about Ebola with Dr. Robert Haley, Dr. Seema Yasmin, and Dr. Christy Columbus, all specialists in infectious disease. If you would like to join the conversation, maybe ask a question, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration opens August 5th. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about the Ebola outbreak in several Western African countries and what that means for healthcare systems and workers around the country. My guests are Dr. Christy Columbus, who is Assistant Medical Director of Infection Control and Disease Prevention for Baylor Scott & White Health North Division, Dr. Seema Yasmin, physician and journalist who has worked as a disease detective at the CDC and is currently a staff writer for the Dallas Morning News and a professor at UT Dallas. And Dr. Robert Haley is here. He worked in hospital infection control at the CDC, and currently he's professor of internal medicine and director of the Division of Epidemiology and Internal Medicine at UT Southwestern Medical Center. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. One concern about the situation in poorly equipped hospitals is that if they are not ready to go with really sophisticated isolation gear, they can actually become amplification points for the disease itself. How does that work exactly?
Typically, it would be that if potentially the healthcare workers who were not wearing personal protective equipment may have been exposed to the blood and body fluids of one patient, they don't effectively cleanse their hands between, they may then potentially transmit blood and body fluids to another patient. The more likely scenario would be that if sterilization practices in hospitals are not up to a high standard, you can actually have transmission of the virus on contaminated surgical instruments or contaminated reusable syringes or contaminated personal protective equipment.
I actually spoke to an expert who goes to West Africa and has just come back from Sierra Leone, and he trains doctors there on how to wear this equipment and protect themselves from Ebola. So I said to him, you know, we've been writing these stories for Dallas Morning News about Dr. Brantley, and we've learned that he was very, very meticulous about wearing his equipment and protecting himself. So how did this happen? And he said to me, do you know what? I've just come back from an Ebola ward where there were 55 infected patients. There were very few doctors and there were no nurses. Mm. So he said, it's not just the equipment. You need to have people that have a high morale. They don't have that at the moment. People are very scared. The nurses understandably are saying, we've had three of our staff die in the past 2 weeks, so we are very scared to go to work. Mm-hmm. And he said what happens is that they become overwhelmed and very, very fatigued, and that's when you make mistakes.
Is that part of the planning, that natural human phenomenon of people suddenly becoming afraid, is that part of the planning that is done in this country to ensure that in the event of a significant outbreak, that you have enough people who are not going to decide that the risk to their lives, or let's face it, you know, the worry that they'll bring something home to their families is so great that they don't want to come to work?
You know, we went through this a decade or two ago with the AIDS and the early HIV problem, and there was a lot of concern originally among hospital workers, nurses, and doctors treating AIDS patients. But I think out of that came a lot of confidence in infection control techniques when we saw that we weren't getting infections in our healthcare workers because we were being careful and we trained people and people take it very seriously. You know, there was a very important experience in 1995 in the Congo, the Republic of Congo. There was a very large epidemic of Ebola. And early in the epidemic, a large number of healthcare workers became ill and died. And then WHO sent in some trainers and trained the residual nursing and medical staff in how to protect themselves with good infection control techniques. And from that time on, there were no more cases in medical workers. And that's often cited as the best evidence that infection control really does work in controlling Ebola. So that's why our confidence here in the United States that there would be little or no transmission to healthcare workers and no transmission to the community. It would really be handled well here because we're really very well prepared.
Outbreaks are driven by fear, And I think we've seen that time and time again. And that's why education is a really key component of outbreak investigations. As much as you want to chase the virus, stop it crossing another border, you have to stop sometimes, stay where you are, and really educate people. And I've spoken to folks on the ground who work for CDC, and they're spending a lot of their time going into villages and saying, if you have these symptoms, don't be scared to come forward. We need to isolate you. And it's understandable that people are scared. They've seen their loved ones taken away from the village, sick but alive, mm-hmm. put into these tense, sometimes scary-looking facilities. And when they exit, they're in a body bag, and they don't know what's happened in the interim. So fear is often fuels outbreaks, and I think it's really important that education happens all along the way.
Yeah, it's said that every epidemic is really three epidemics: an epidemic of disease, followed by an epidemic of fear, followed by an epidemic of meetings. And here we are. but the fear factor is really, really critical. In fact, that's probably responsible for a lot of the amplification of this epidemic in West Africa right now. Of course, you know, this is an area that's affected by some civil strife, some revolutionary activity, which breaks down social institutions and makes it more difficult to transmit, makes people more frightened. In fact, we've even seen reports, Dr. Yasmin reported this in one of her articles, that in some of the villages, the people are actually so afraid they're blaming the aid workers for possibly bringing it in, or using this as a way of gaining, raising money or something. And so they're attacking the aid workers. So it's the fear is a major amplifying factor.
We have an email here from a tweet from George, who wants to know about that all-important day 10. How does one determine day 10? Does that mean once symptomatic?
Yes, it's once the patient is symptomatic. Day one would be the first day the patient develops symptoms, so 10 days into the symptoms.
There's another interesting time course. I think on average, when somebody develops Ebola, for the first 4 or 5 days, it's just a flu-like illness. And then somewhere around day five, it transitions to a more systemic illness where you get involvement of the liver and kidney failure and much more vomiting and diarrhea. So it sort of transitions at 5 days. And then if by 10 days, if you're not going downhill and dying, chances are you're going to survive.
Is there a quick test to determine whether it's Ebola or malaria or influenza or something else?
There are. You can do pretty much rule out malaria with a fairly quick test on blood smears. Over in Africa, I believe that they have a test in which they can detect the viral antigen quickly. Another way you can test it or can detect it quickly would be by sophisticated molecular techniques like polymerase chain reaction. Also, if you could grow it in viral culture, and also if sometimes, and usually it's not that early in the course of the illness, you can develop an early system of, or an early type of antibody that can be detected in the blood as well. But from what I understand, it's the antigen detection test that is being used in the field.
But we've also learned that sometimes courier services are refusing to take the blood samples and even take them from the hospital to the lab. Mm. So sometimes the doctors just can't get a test at all.
Because people are so afraid of even carrying a sample.
Absolutely. Even when they're being told about all the correct precautions and about the fact that it would be safe to transport the blood in these conditions, they're refusing.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone to Toby in Richardson. Hi, Toby.
Hi. I wanted to ask your experts, they were talking a bit earlier about people traveling, and specifically in DFW, since that's where we are, what precautions are taken when people land. Two things. One, I'm wondering what on earth they would do. They talk about symptomatic patients, obviously, people showing a fever, something like that. But what could they possibly do about an asymptomatic person who isn't really showing signs yet but is going to develop the the disease if they the virus if they have it. And then also there are people who they mentioned that there are like flu-like symptoms, but there are people who I imagine those symptoms are worse or not quite so bad. So you could have somebody who actually does have the symptoms, but you know, if you have a low-grade fever, I've never heard of anybody being asked about that on a plane or something like that. The other thing also is, real quickly...
Well, hang on. You know, Toby, we've got a lot of questions already, so thank you so much for your call. We'll get the ones that you've presented answered.
Yeah, I think it would be most likely that somebody who's incubating the disease but not yet sick, it'd be most likely that they would get off the plane and go to where, let's say they came in DFW, they would probably go out to wherever they were going to go, to a relative's house or to a meeting or something, and then they would develop symptoms there. Presumably, they would probably sit around their hotel or their relative's house for a day or two until they started feeling very bad, and they would go see a doctor or to an emergency room. And we in Dallas County, we're very fortunate that we've got great communication among our medical staff. Our Dallas County Medical Society has a blast fax set up and an email set up, so they are emailing and can get the word out to any doctor in town. And so they're already are communicating the CDC recommendations on how to handle this situation. That's already gone out to all of our doctors. And so presumably an alert doctor would ask them their travel history. And the key is if somebody has a flu-like illness, but they've been in West Africa or they've been caring for somebody who had Ebola or they were testing monkeys in Africa, in Congo or something, that they would get that history and quickly they would then put that person in isolation, alert the county health department, the local and state health departments, and call the CDC. And then that case would be very carefully worked up. Anybody who had been exposed to that person during the time that they were symptomatic would be notified. A caseworker from the county health department would probably go see them and let them know what they'd been exposed to, and then caution them if they get fever to call immediately, and then they would be cared for carefully so that it wouldn't spread further. So Dallas County and Tarrant County as well, we're very organized, and I think would be on top of this and would pick it up pretty quickly.
Here in North Texas, many of us are familiar with that phenomenon where a tornado touches down and wreaks havoc and then suddenly just sort of recedes back into the clouds. And I've been thinking about that sort of metaphor for a disease like Ebola, which makes many people sick and is very scary and then sort of goes away for a while. What do we know about where it is when it is not infecting human beings?
It seems to be in natural history of the disease, it seems to have animal reservoirs, and it probably is in the animal reservoir, and for whatever reason, a human being has not come in contact with the animal reservoir or another animal that may have been infected with Ebola virus.
Yeah, I think there's pretty good evidence in Africa that, in Central Africa particularly, that this resides somehow, it stays alive in fruit bats. And the fruit bats then presumably will bite or be consumed perhaps by a monkey or a gorilla, and then you'll get a little epidemic going. And then it transmits gorilla to gorilla, monkey to monkey. And actually often it's been observed sometimes you get a big die-off of the primate population before it then spills over into, before a human person will then maybe eat some meat called bush meat, which might be monkeys that have been killed and then are sold for food. And then one person gets it, and then it spreads to their relatives, and then you get person-to-person spread. That seems to be how it goes. Now, you're right, though. What's really interesting is a lot of these little epidemics, they come, they spread around a while, and then they just seem to disappear, and I don't think anybody knows why. We would like to think that it's our education and our aid workers that go in, But there seems to be just, it's same, maybe they just burn themselves out somehow. We don't really know the answer. Do you all know that?
I think it's also the natural evolution of the virus. Yeah. We kind of see these cycles that we talk about of outbreaks every few years. And that's common through other viruses and other infectious diseases as well.
Do we know how old Ebola is? Do we suspect that it existed before it was named and classified?
So it was discovered in 1976, but now people have looked back and think that there were earlier outbreaks in the early 70s, maybe even earlier, that were actually Ebola, but we didn't know that it was Ebola at that time.
Yeah, there's genetic evidence. Geneticists can have a way of estimating how old the virus is by looking at its genetic material, and it's estimated to be well over tens of thousands of years old. So it's not a new virus that's just cropped up. It's first recognized in 76, but there's also some evidence that there was a in Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War, the 400 BC, there was a great plague in Athens. And Thucydides described this plague very, very thoroughly. And there's been a case made that that may have been an Ebola introduction into Athens. It may have been a typhoid fever, but some evidence that it might have. It looks very much like Ebola. So this may have been with us a long time just before it was recognized.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Carol in Allen. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I've been listening with great interest to your speakers and questions. As most of us may experience 1 to 10 hour emergency wait time. If the person cannot speak for themselves, they're so ill, or they can't, discuss, the background of their travel history, what is being done to, before the diagnosis, to prevent people who are also in the emergency waiting room from getting this. And
thank you very much, Carol. Appreciate your call.
Typically, if a patient presented to the emergency room in such a dire type of situation, they would be triaged immediately back, most likely to a private room, and would not remain in the waiting room. Because the disease is not spread by airborne route, typically then patients in the waiting room would not be at risk because they didn't come into contact with that patient's blood or body fluids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a good point to emphasize. In terms of spreadability of a virus, Ebola is only a moderately infectious agent. It's not a highly infectious agent. So you really have to work a little bit at being exposed to get it. So people shouldn't look at this like measles or chicken pox. Those are influenza, which are highly infectious agents. They just will go through a whole community. This is not like that. It's more indolent. You have to work at it to get it.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the current Ebola outbreak in three Western African countries with Dr. Robert Haley, Dr. Seema Yasmin, and Dr. Christy Columbus. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Ask your question via email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration opens August 5th. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're getting an update on what scientists know about the current Ebola outbreak from Dr. Seema Yasmin, a physician and journalist who has worked as a disease detective at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. She's currently a staff writer at the Dallas Morning News and a professor at UT Dallas. Dr. Christy Columbus is Assistant Medical Director of Infection Control and Disease Prevention for Baylor Scott & White Health North Division. And Dr. Robert Haley worked in Vaccine Hospital Infection Control at the CDC. Currently, he's professor of internal medicine and director of the Division of Epidemiology and Internal Medicine at UT Southwestern Medical Center. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org. We have an email here from Charlene who wants to know if there are any known residual effects for the survivors of Ebola.
By and large, when people recover from Ebola, they get completely well. There are some cases that have been reported where people will have a prolonged recovery, and particularly men. For some reason, there's an infection of the prostate that may linger on for a long time and make them infectious for a long time, actually, from sexual exposure. But that's very, very unusual. By and large, they get over it when they get well.
So there's a very few people actually survive Ebola. We think between 10 to 40%. But even those that make a full recovery, as Dr. Haley just described, we've learned often shunned from their communities. Mm-hmm. Just again, because of that fear and lack of education, people may suspect that they might still be infectious. So they've made this miraculous recovery and survived the infection and then can't go back to their family sometimes.
God forbid there's an Ebola outbreak anywhere, but if it were to happen in Dallas or Tokyo or Geneva or a place where medical systems are fully equipped with the latest gear to keep everybody safe, do we think the survival rate would be closer to that 40% overall? Could it be even higher than that?
I think it really could be, and we're already seeing that with Dr. Brantley and Nancy Wright. Well, I mean, they have received an experimental serum, but just the fact that with Dr. Brantley, he recognized symptoms in himself very quickly, and he did all the right things immediately. He isolated himself. He told colleagues. They were able to provide him with supportive treatment. And I've spoken to other infectious disease experts who are experts in Ebola, and they said, look, these really catastrophic death rates are not just reflective of the virus, but reflective of where the outbreak is happening. We're looking at countries that have had their entire health systems devastated by years, sometimes decades of civil war. There's poverty. There's just a lack of public health infrastructure. It's not designed to deal with an infection like this. If we were ever to see Ebola arrive, you know, on a passenger who lands at DFW, as we've mentioned, it'd be contained much quicker. We have the healthcare system and the public health infrastructure to stop an outbreak like this becoming so big.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Mark in Colleyville. Hello, Mark.
Hi, how y'all doing?
Very well, thank you.
My entire education in microbiology came from the fictional novel, The Andromeda Strain. How common is it for viruses to actually mutate, and what would be the chances of, and has it actually happened in our lifetime where a virus that is just bodily fluids transmitted suddenly be spread by mosquitoes, for instance?
There's no doubt that some viruses are prone to mutating. And it turns out there are two classes of viruses. There are viruses that are more well-developed, that are based on a DNA core. They have DNA. And those are very stable viruses that don't change appreciably. But then there are another class of viruses that have a core of RNA, which is a more primitive molecule. DNA has a system for checking itself. So if it mutates, it will destroy a cell that mutates. But RNA doesn't have that. So RNA viruses tend to mutate rapidly. Influenza is a good example. You know, almost every year we need a new flu vaccine because the organism has mutated to a strain that will not be controlled by your vaccine. Ebola is an RNA virus that will mutate. In fact, there are five different strains of Ebola virus. The one that's circulating right now in West Africa is the original strain that occurred in Congo and southern Sudan in 1976. But it's mutated several times, and in different countries in Central Africa and in Congo, you've seen very different viruses, very different versions of this one. But I think also more common would be like in the 1918 influenza epidemic. The initial wave of that epidemic was highly fatal, but as it as it was passed through more and more millions of people, it mutated, and the second and third waves were much less likely to be fatal. So when they mutate, they're probably in the circumstance of an epidemic, the mutation is more likely to tame it and make it less virulent over time. It's interesting.
Forgive me for what I'm sure to all three of you is a very naive question, but why is it that we have good, reliable vaccines for some viral diseases, including those like influenza that mutate, but we're usually able to kind of get out ahead of that, and for others, we haven't been able to develop effective vaccines?
There are so many responses, answers to that question. I think maybe we can focus on two. One is the science. It can just be very challenging. This is a highly contagious virus. You need to be in a very expensive, highly equipped lab to deal with this. There are very few of those in the world. The other that some people have put forward over the past few weeks is market. Maybe there isn't a big enough market for this vaccine. There are other diseases that wipe out many hundreds of thousands of people every year. So it may be that there's a focus on developing vaccines and treatments for those illnesses as opposed to Ebola, which is horrific and deadly, but kills far fewer people compared to some other things.
Also, for example, the HIV virus, it's resisted our best efforts so far developing an effective vaccine. And there's been a lot of effort and a lot of money spent, and so far it's not been effective. And that is probably because the HIV virus has an ability to hide its vulnerable parts, if you will. Its antigens are hidden
from the body's defenses.
From the body's defenses. And so you just can't get a vaccine at it. I think that in that case, that's part of the problem.
With Ebola, we do have a vaccine that works very effectively in monkeys.
Yes.
It's been tested in them, and it's given in a kind of non-traditional way that we think about vaccines. It's given after they've become infected. But it's been shown to be very, very useful for them, and it just hasn't been tested in humans yet.
Is there a reason? I mean, when someone is desperately ill, it seems like there's nothing to lose. Is it simply not ready? Even if there's a ghost of a chance that it might work?
It's an ethical conundrum. It's a scientific conundrum. Mm-hmm. I mean, it hasn't even been tested in phase one clinical trials, which is where you just test it in healthy humans for safety. Mm-hmm. And some people say that, trying to dispatch this vaccine, this experimental vaccine, to thousands of affected people in an outbreak could just be the worst time ever to test something that could go horribly wrong.
There's also an ethical concern about what people can you test a vaccine on? And, people who are uneducated and don't know what the issues are, they really are not in a position to give an informed consent. But I think in this particular case, this doctor and the nurse who were working full time in Ebola, they knew all the issues. And I think that was a good example of where they really could give informed consent. They knew exactly what the issues were. And I think that probably played into the decision of probably the NIH and FDA quickly agreeing to allow this new agent to be tested on them, because they were able to really give truly informed consent.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Manfred in Dallas. Hi, Manfred.
Hi, Chris. Great subject. I just would like to say that I think it's overpopulation is contributing to all of this emerging diseases, because we're clearing more and more forests, we're interacting more and more with wild animals and places we don't usually go to, and then there are more of us to interact with one another, modern transportation, so I think we will encounter more viruses out there that could really harm us.
I think that's true. There's a term we use in public health. It's called R0, and it's the basic reproduction number of an infection or an infectious agent. And so anytime R0 for a virus or bacteria is greater than one, it means that one person can pass it on to one more person. Sometimes the R0 number is 2, or in the case of measles, it's 18. What researchers have found is that the R0 for Ebola ranges between 1.3 to 1.8, but that number goes up once you look at a more densely populated area. And even a small increase in that number could mean an exponential, a much bigger outbreak, and just seeing far greater spread of the disease.
Also, the development of Africa, I think, has had a lot to do with the emergence of some new pathogens, HIV, for example, and Ebola. you know, over the last 50 years or so, there's been great development. The Trans-African Highway was developed, and that then put a highway right through a part of Africa that no, in many cases, no human had ever been. And so it just brought much more rapid mixing of populations and much more potential than for these to escape these diseases, new disease or old diseases from the center of Africa that had been bottled up forever, to escape out to the rest of the world.
What do we know about the most effective ways to educate local populations about things that they can do on the ground? It's well and good for us to worry about this from the safety of the United States, but for the people who truly are at risk right now, what does work to help them take appropriate steps?
Something that CDC is doing in these three countries is reaching out to cultural leaders, religious leaders, respected elders in villages, and focusing on them and gaining their trust before going into the village. Like we said, there's so much fear and misunderstanding about Ebola. It's really actually the fear that's fueling this outbreak. So by reaching out to trusted elders and trusted people in these communities, it's a really good way of building trust and getting the information out there.
We should also commend all of the people who are willing to go to these horrible, dangerous situations and provide education and direct health care and manage and epidemiologic surveillance to monitor these things. You know, we have a worldwide public health network, which is really, I think, the heart of it is the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. It's one of our great world resources for our country as well as the world. And then the WHO, the World Health Organization, Pan American Health Organization in this hemisphere, WHO. And then all the state health departments, local health departments in the United States. This axis is highly effective, along with universities and so forth, very, very important in monitoring these things worldwide. You remember when SARS erupted in China? It was denied for a little while, but really in a matter of 3 or 4 months, we went from recognizing this new disease all the way to developing all the control measures and sequencing the virus in about 3 or 4 months. And it's just gone to light speed in the ability to handle these things. So I think most people don't realize how important this worldwide public health network is.
You are correct, and I highly commend folks out there. I have friends and former disease detectives from the CDC currently in West Africa dealing with this outbreak. But nothing makes up for having that local public health infrastructure, yes, and that local healthcare system in place. And that's really what developed with this outbreak at the beginning and why it spread from maybe 10 people to 1,000 so quickly, is just that lack of local healthcare infrastructure. And I think one of the most important things that CDC is doing actually is saying, sure, we'll come out and we'll help you in any instance like this, but what we'll also do is help train your local doctors, your local veterinarians, your local nurses, so that they can actually deal with these outbreaks themselves and deal with them really early on.
What do you say to people who are just sort of temperamentally susceptible to becoming really fearful in situations like this? People who might be living within our listening area and can't get this out of their minds. Do you have words of comfort?
Don't be scared. We have a great public health system here. Even if someone does land on a flight from West Africa at DFW, very quickly the virus would be contained and we wouldn't see spread like we're seeing in West Africa.
Every one of our hospitals has a very well-developed infection control program with an infection control committee and a group of people that study this and maintain good precautions in their hospitals. So, in fact, I heard Dr. Frieden at the CDC, that director of CDC, just say yesterday that, you know, that they've taken these extra special precautions for Dr. Brantley and bringing him in. But this a person with Ebola infection could be admitted to any U.S. hospital, and we would have every expectation that it would not spread because of how active it is.
Sorry, we need to worry more about further spread in West Africa, yes, as opposed to spread in America and Europe.
Great, exactly. Perspective. Thank you. Dr. Seema Yasmin is a physician and journalist who's worked as a disease detective at CDC. She's currently a staff writer at the Dallas Morning News and a professor at UT Dallas. Dr. Christy Columbus is Assistant Medical Director of Infection Control and Disease Prevention for Baylor Scott and White Health North Division. And Dr. Robert Haley worked in hospital infection control at the CDC. Currently, he's Professor of Internal Medicine and directs the Division of Epidemiology and Internal Medicine at UT Southwestern Medical Center. Got through all of that in with enough time to say thank you all very much for being with us. Really appreciate it. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.